Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great Acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene. I'm Mike Osborne. Today on the show, Jackson Roach brings us a story about a tree, Ginkgo biloba. Ginkgo has an evolutionary history that goes back hundreds of millions of years, and it's also, arguably, humankind's first conservation project. I could say a lot more, but it's better to just listen. Here's the story.
The leaf of the ginkgo tree is unlike the leaf of any other tree you've seen and known. It has a very long leaf stalk, and then it quickly fans out into the shape of a Japanese fan, almost. And the leaves are a nice bright green, and they turn a really beautiful buttery yellow in the fall. And the veins on the leaf are very unusual as well. They fan out radially from the base of the blade, the leaf blade, and they keep dividing into two up to the very end, to the edge of the leaf. So it's very pleasing to the shape of the leaf is very pleasing. Occasionally you'll find these round seeds that look like small apricots beneath trees. These are the seeds of the female ginkgos. You don't see a lot of female ginkgos. And when the flesh that surrounds, the flesh on the outside of that seed decomposes, the smell could be quite unpleasant. Some people think it smells like really ripe aged cheeses. In the US, you see them as street trees and in parks. In China and Japan, I've heard various temples have ginkgo trees. There's a thought that temples, Buddhist temples in particular, might have been instrumental in keeping ginkgo biloba, the species we have, in cultivation over the centuries. There were various related species, but those have all gone extinct. And ginkgo biloba is the only remaining one. Way before humans evolved, ginkgo-like trees were present, and so looking at one, it's good to ponder that this tree has been around for a long time.
What we mainly have in the fossil record are leaves. They start to appear over 200 million years ago in the fossil record. There's no mistaking them as ginkgo leaves. When you crack them out of the rock, they look very, very similar to a modern ginkgo. You know, we see ginkgo appearing in the Triassic and being pretty widespread and abundant during the Jurassic. Climate was a good deal warmer. Probably no ice caps during the Jurassic or even during the Cretaceous. So this was a warm world. Ginkgo seems to have grown close to river deposits. So it was growing alongside the rivers in these ancient dinosaur landscapes. And this was the dinosaur age. In the landscapes of the Jurassic, where ginkgo was so common, the vertebrate fauna would have been very different. The vegetation was dominated by cycads and conifers and ferns. We didn't have any flowering plants yet. The pollination system in ginkgo was probably by the wind and didn't involve insects. It is possible that the smell of those smelly seeds may have been an attractant for dinosaurs or perhaps other vertebrates during the Jurassic, and that those vertebrates were involved in dispersing ginkgo seeds. And then it spread across the planet. Intriguing, I think, is that it did last for so long and it was so resilient. Ginkgo and its relatives were widespread in both the northern and southern hemispheres. But then eventually the world did change around ginkgo and ginkgo found it hard, in a sense, to keep up. It's hard to come up with a very clear answer as to why ginkgo, having done so well for 100 million years or more, suddenly starts to find itself in retreat. The vegetation of the world really started to change at about 100 million years ago with the rise of flowering plants. It's probable that ginkgo, having grown in these habitats without flowering plants, was then subjected to new kinds of competition from a new kind of plant that, for whatever reason, proved to be more successful. And they winnowed out some of the ginkgo like diversity that we knew back in the Jurassic. Eventually it does start to decline in its distribution and its abundance through the middle of the Cretaceous about 100 million years ago. And then the world changed again after the end of the Cretaceous with the demise of the dinosaurs. Ginkgo was still living in a world that had very high temperatures. Ginkgo was growing at very high latitudes, but as the temperature started to cool through the Cenozoic, ginkgo became more and more restricted. Soon it's lost in the southern hemisphere. It's still quite widespread in the northern hemisphere. But then as the climate starts to deteriorate, the trauma of the ice ages about 40 million years ago, we see that ginkgo moves into lower latitudes from these very high latitudes. And we also see eventually towards the end of the Cenozoic, it's slowly lost regionally. We have it in Western North America based on its leaves up to about 15 million years ago. Then we don't see it anymore in North America. In Europe, we have it until about 5 to 2 million years ago. Then we don't see it anymore. In Japan, we have it up to about 2 to 5 million years ago. Then it's lost. And the place where ginkgo seems to survive is in China. And it's in China then where ginkgo very, very nearly went extinct. In the past, there were several different kinds of ginkgo-like plants, and those have been gradually winnowed out to the one species in China.
Right. Okay. That's helpful. So, and then it meets humans.
Yes, so the first written records of ginkgo from China about 1,000 years ago. Ginkgo are being written about in poems as a nut tree, collecting those smelly seeds and eating the meat. This was regarded as a delicacy and an interesting new food plant. It does appear to have associations with people that transcend its simple usefulness. You often find ginkgo associated with, for example, Buddhist temples or Shinto shrines. I think also the distinctive appearance of the leaves is part of this. It's a very distinctive tree, which may have been part of why it becomes associated with these various belief systems. People began to cultivate it, and so it spread across China, and then to Korea, and then to Japan in medieval times. And we have this wonderful example of the Xin'an ship that went down with its cargo of ceramics that also included many plant remains, including a single ginkgo seed, as direct evidence that ginkgo was being moved at that time. So that pretty much fits with the first appearance of ginkgo in the Japanese written record around about the 13, 1400s. And it's really only a matter of a few hundred years after that that the first Westerners in the East start to encounter ginkgo. So Engelbert Kempfer, who was working for the Dutch East India Company in southern Japan at their trading post in Deshima in Nagasaki Harbor, he arrived there in the early 1690s. And in his book, which he wrote on his return, that came out in 1712, he publishes the first in the Western scientific community, the first description and illustration of ginkgo, and uses the name ginkgo for the first time. And then, pretty soon after that, it's clear that living specimens had arrived in Europe as a horticultural and botanical novelty. The oldest ginkgo trees in Europe are of about that age, maybe 1740s, 1750s. When Linnaeus writes his Species Plantarum in the 1750s, he doesn't include ginkgo because at that point he hadn't seen a specimen. But just before his death, around about 1770, Linnaeus is sent a living specimen. And so Linnaeus sees it and names it ginkgo biloba. By the early 19th century, it was being grown on estates and botanical gardens, and this is where Goethe comes across it and writes his famous poem on it. By the end of the 18th century, ginkgo is already being grown in North America. So in a sense, ginkgo is now growing in some of the places from which it was extinguished millions of years ago. And in the 20th century, we've come to realize that it's a useful street tree, tough, resilient, resistant. So now you can see it as one of the most common street trees in Manhattan, or in Beijing, or in Seoul, or in Tokyo. Ginkgo was probably on the edge of extinction until people found it useful. But then through its use as a nut tree, as a horticultural ornamental, then even as a medicinal, and now as a street tree, it's grown very widely around the world. And really, from 1,000 years ago onward, you know, the well-being and the survival of ginkgo is entirely tied up with its interaction with people. So that's why I say that in some respects, ginkgo is a tree that people have saved. You know, conservation through cultivation. It just reminds us about time. I mean, these are long-lived organisms, visible organisms, that transcend a normal human lifetime. only the life of individual trees, which may be very long compared to a human lifespan, but also the lifespan of the lineage, which is almost incomprehensible. Thinking about ginkgo in this way, there's a life story that's taken place over hundreds of millions of years, should, I think, sort of calibrate for us our place in the world. We're all so preoccupied with the here and now. We're all so preoccupied with what's going to happen tomorrow, what's going to happen in the next election cycle, when's the next economic cycle. And in the grand sweep of Earth history and evolutionary history, these are small peripheral events. We are relatively recent arrivals on this planet. We're a relatively recent product of evolution. Yet we dominate the planet today, and as we think about the way we manage the world, we might want to extend our timescales a little bit and think about these longer timescales. The fact of the matter is we have the power of a geological force on the planet now, so the decisions that we make have major implications for the rest of life on the planet. But I think it's helpful for us to kind of to step back and think about our place in the unfolding history of the world and how, given that, we should interact with the natural world.
On August 6, 1945, the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Six ginkgo trees were caught in the blast radius, but survived the explosion, though their branches were stripped of leaves. The next spring, these same six trees leafed out again. And as it turns out, there were also ginkgo trees on the grounds of the University of Chicago, where Enrico Fermi developed the bomb, and a ginkgo tree around the corner from Harry Truman's house, the man who gave the order. Ginkgos have a way of showing up throughout history, and for an unparalleled account of these kinds of stories, we highly recommend the book Ginkgo, The Tree That Time Forgot, by Sir Peter Crane. Dr. Crane was the British voice we heard in this piece. He's also president of the Oak Spring Garden Foundation. The other voice we heard at the beginning of this story was Cyrus Patel, who runs the Trees of Stanford website and occasionally leads tree walks around campus. Thanks again to Jackson Roach for that story. Our show is also produced by Leslie Chang, Miles Traer, and me, Mike Osborne. Special thanks to Tom Hayden and Isha Salian. Our project is supported by Worldview Stanford and Stanford Earth. You can learn more about the podcast online at www.genanthro.com. On our website, you can also find links to music used in this piece. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter @GenAnthropocene. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back on Thursday with a new episode.